This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 554,000 people have lost their lives due to COVID-19 globally, more than 133,000 in the U.S. The number of infections exceeds 12.2 million globally and more than 3.1 in the United States. As the Trump administration presses the nation's school systems to reopen in the fall, some health experts are saying that the places at high risk of exposing people to the coronavirus may need to stay closed for children to get back to school safely. They are urging federal, state, and local officials to reconsider how they are reopening the broader economy and to prioritize K-12 schools over places like gyms and bars. The effort could require closing other establishments to help curb the virus spread and give children the best shot at returning to classrooms. The aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt has returned home to San Diego, led by a new captain who came aboard after the previous one was fired over the handling of a massive COVID-19 outbreak on board. There were no embraces on the Navy pier, typical of such homecomings. Instead, sailors disembarked one by one and walked to waiting vehicles to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. The aircraft carrier in late March was sidelined in Guam for 10 weeks with an outbreak. Over time, more than 1,000 were infected with COVID-19, and the captain, Brett Crozier, was fired for urging his commanders to take faster action. The governor of the U.S. state of Arizona, Doug Ducey, is ordering restaurants to work at half of their capacity, but he's declined to shut them down entirely as authorities seek to control a strong coronavirus outbreak that has doubled the daily case count in 2 weeks. The governor also said the state will increase testing with a focus on low-income areas of Phoenix, as many people report it hard to impossible to find tests. This is VOA News. As the nation continues to address racism and the place in U.S. history that it's had, the Pentagon's top leaders told Congress that the U.S. military needed to take a hard look at symbols of the Confederacy at U.S. Army bases, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, said that he had recommended a commission to look at that issue. He added that the Confederacy, the American Civil War, was fought, and it was an act of rebellion. It was an act of treason at the time against the Union, against the Stars and Stripes, against the U.S. Constitution, and those officers turned their backs on their oath. He went on to say some have a different view of that. Some think it's heritage. Others think it's hate. The way we should do it matters as much as that we should do it. So we need to take a hard look at the bases, the statues, the names, and all that stuff. Defense Secretary Mark Esper said a review of Confederate flags at bases was also underway. U.S. military bases named for Confederate military leaders are all located in former Confederate states. Many of those states helped elect Mr. Trump, President Trump, in 2016. Longtime Seoul City Mayor Park Won-soon has been found dead, according to police. This comes after his daughter reported him missing, saying that his phone was off and that he had left a message like a will. Hundreds of police took part in the hours-long search utilizing both drones and dogs. The Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency said the mayor's body was found at Mount Bugak in northern Seoul around midnight, near where his phone signal had last been detected. The agency did not give a cause of death. A police official told reporters at a televised briefing at the scene there was no sign of foul play, although a detailed investigation would be needed. As mayor of the city of nearly 10 million people, Park was one of South Korea's most influential politicians and played a high role in its response to the coronavirus pandemic. He was seen as a potential presidential hopeful for the liberals in the 2022 presidential elections. The White House is set to finalize plans this week that will bar any part of the U.S. government from buying high-tech goods or services from any company that uses products from five Chinese companies, including Huawei. A U.S. government official tells Reuters exclusively that as part of that plan, any company looking for a go-around would have to request a waiver as the Trump administration throws down an ultimatum. That is, do business with the U.S. government or do business with the Chinese, but you can't do both. This is likely to have sweeping effects since any U.S. company that wants to sell high-tech devices to the U.S. government must certify that none of the components come from Huawei or the other companies. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
covering Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Friday, July 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's president offered a compromise on Thursday, but protesters will march today to demand his resignation.
The talk that he did last night, the speech he had last night, was an insult to Mali. You know, we just lost 36 people in a village in Bankas. He didn't even mention those people. So we believe that he doesn't know what's going on in the country. We need a new direction for the country.
Uganda opposition groups say next year's election ballot papers should be printed overseas. Meanwhile, Uganda deploys its army to stop cross-border cattle raids and looting. And Sudan's prime minister reshuffles his cabinet, dropping three key ministers.
Everything is the prime minister. Food, paper, medicine, social security, peace process, everything is evaluated. And people are suffering from the lack of the dealing with.
And the United Nations said landmines planted by Libyan rebels in the capital, Tripoli, are killing people. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition and pro-democracy groups in Mali say their nationwide protest is scheduled for today, Friday, to force the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita will take place, despite the fact that the president offered a compromise yesterday, Thursday. In a speech to the nation Thursday, Mr. Keita offered to restructure the country's constitutional court. Reforming the court was one of a litany of demands made by the protesters. Dr. Ramata Siseko Sise, president of the Change in Mali movement, said the renewed protest will take the form of a peaceful civil disobedience, including occupation of all government buildings throughout the country. Dr. Sise says the constitutional court sided with President Keita during this year's April parliamentary elections, despite widespread fraud.
During the election in 2018, the presidential election, there were massive fraud in every part of the country where they just put ballots in boxes for him. And the constitutional court declared him winner, although there are many people who protested and contested the result. But the court who he appointed has been his friends and family defending him, even though they knew that he did not win the election. And the people were protesting since 2018 when they declared him winner, when we know he didn't win. Then the other day, we had a legislative election where they have massive fraud, which just ignited the fire that we had already. So the Constitutional Court approved the result, even though there are massive fraud everywhere, with videos, with pictures, with everything. So that's why we said we don't believe the Constitutional Court, and we don't trust him, we don't trust his government. We want him to resign along with his government and the Constitutional Court and the General Assembly, who was elected, we call it nominated, by him. Because there was no election, it was massive fraud everywhere in the country.
If I am right, Dr. Sise, resignation of the president was not one of the points outlined by the ECOWAS mediators. Do you not think that by insisting on resignation of the president, that your movement might fall out of goodwill with ECOWAS?
Actually, when we demanded his resignation, we had a talk with ECOWAS because we really believe in international community. We believe in international good relationship with the Mali. We listened to them and we dropped the resignation and we took in account the propositions that were made by ECOWAS. And we told him that he should not step down, but he should let a full competency prime minister rule the country, who will be chosen by everybody, not just him. He refused that. That's why we went back to his resignation, because we don't believe that he can rule the country. So we still listen to ECOWAS. We're still talking to them because we believe in dialogue. We believe in collaboration. We really believe in that. And we said that since he does not have the trust of the people, he could step aside, let the prime minister be chosen, be nominated, somebody who is competent, who is not corrupt like his government, so that we can have new direction for the country. Now the ECOWAS themselves are confident that we listened to them, we went to talk with them, and we said we dropped the resignation. He needs to just dissolve the General Assembly, and he needs to set aside. But he refused that. That's why we went back and said, guess what? He just needs to resign, because at this point, he lost the trust of everybody. And the talk that he did last night, the speech he had last night, was an insult to Malian. You know, we just lost 36 people in a village in Bankas. He didn't even mention those people. So we believe that he's not in the contact with people. He's not, he doesn't know what's going on in the country. We believe he's not even ruling the country. There are some young people around him who are making all the decisions. And we believe that the country is more serious. We have 19 million people in Mali. You know, many people who are devoted, intellectual people who can do something for this country. Because of few people who are corrupt on top of the government, they control everything. This is just a new revolution for Mali, basically. We need a new direction for the country. And he cannot give that to the people.
Dr. Cisse, thank you very much again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
No problem. Thank you for talking to me.
Dr. Oramanta Sissoko Cisse is the president of the Change in Mali movement. She was speaking with us from Lawrenceville, Georgia. A majority of Ugandan opposition political parties said ballot papers for the 2021 general elections should be printed overseas because doing so locally would undermine the security and credibility of the polls. The Electoral Commission says it has launched an advertising campaign inviting bids from both local and foreign companies. The ruling National Resistance Movement, the NRM, and the Uganda People's Congress, the UPC, say they are not opposed to printing the voting materials locally, except that they are concerned about security. Alice Alasso is the acting national coordinator for the opposition Alliance for National Transformation Party. She tells VOA's Peter Clotty that in order to ensure transparency and credibility of the election, the ballot papers should be printed overseas while allowing political parties to monitor the process.
Well, it is based on the fact that for a long time in the previous elections, one of the prominent issues has been ballot stuffing. And we understand ballot stuffing to mean somebody irregularly accesses ballot papers prior to polling, retakes, puts them back to him over voting that day. In which case, if that has been happening when the ballot papers are done outside the country, how much more when they are printed locally under the supervision of internal security organizations, the NRM functionaries, and in what they are dubbing a scientific election. It certainly would be very, very problematic to give them the leeway to print those ballot papers here in Uganda.
But Ms. Alasso, let me ask you, what about people in Uganda saying the policy of BUBU, buy Uganda, build Uganda? What happens to that policy that printing it in Uganda will save Ugandans a lot of money, as well as ensure that all opposition groups are part of the printing process to monitor, to ensure that there's no ballot stuffing? Wouldn't this help?
First of all, BUBU is not exclusive as a policy. It is not exclusive to international participation of international companies. We have not locked out and said that Uganda is now an island and it will buy trade within itself. No. We have BUBU, we promote it where we have an advantage and where it is in the best interest of the country. In which case, when we talk about printing outside, it is also in the best interest of the country to guarantee or to assure stakeholders that the process at least will be done by credible organizations and not tampered with. We are imagining that if we go for international bidding to print this, especially with a focus to credible companies, they have something at stake. They have a name. They have their credibility at stake to protect. But if you do it here locally, the way the NRM has been intimidating actors in the political field, intimidating businessmen in Kampala, the way people live in fear in this city, I can assure you they will raid that printer, they will take away materials, they will print in excess, and this whole process, which is already under serious threat, will just be watered down.
Alice Alasso is the acting national coordinator for the Opposition Alliance for National Transformation Party. She was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from the capital, Kampala. The Uganda People's Defense Force, UPDF, has deployed to stop the resurgence of cross-border cattle raids and looting by armed attackers from South Sudan. In a meeting with their Ugandan counterparts, the South Sudan government pledged to stop its troops from entering and destabilizing the area and to return looted property and money. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Ugandans have reported an increase in intrusions by armed South Sudan gunmen who use porous border crossings to terrorize residents and snatch their property, money and livestock. Major David Opera is the UPDF West Nile Brigade Commander.
The locals in this place re-emphasized what they went through in terms of disturbance by armed men who come from South Sudan.
There have been numerous gunfire exchanges between Ugandan soldiers and the South Sudanese, which have resulted in deaths and casualties. Opera says the two governments have agreed on joint border patrols to tackle the criminal elements.
Now we have joined up with the South Sudan leadership. We have got to enhance liaison from both sides. We have identified the key people whom we are going to work with from the other side, because we realized there was a communication gap in the sense that the commanders at the other end were reluctant to work with us this side. Now there is going to be more information flowing in. Whenever armed people are coming in, we should be able to come in quickly. But our emphasis is in a peaceful resolution of this mess which is here.
South Sudan military attache to Uganda, Brigadier General Tik Bolgir, has been on a fact-finding mission in Uganda regarding the complaints. He said his government will recover and return the stolen property, money and livestock once investigations are complete. The general also noted that the South Sudan government will fight to minimize illegal crossing of armed men into Uganda.
I promise you, by all means, they are going to stop coming here. We have three movements here. There is the government forces, there is IO, who was fighting the government. There is still resisting force now of RAS-NAS. They are still at large in your border here. So we don't know who is really disturbing. Is it our people, soldiers, or from these rebels? If it is from our soldiers, we are going to deal with them. Advise the people to remain calm.
Statistics indicate about 130 cattle have been looted from Ugandans in the Lamu border district alone since January. A number of Ugandans have abandoned their farms and businesses at the border in fear of the attacks. Leaders from South Sudan and Uganda have asked residents to report such incidents quickly so they are dealt with immediately. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 10th. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok undertook a major cabinet reshuffle on Thursday, dismissing his foreign, finance, and energy and health ministers. Three other cabinet post holders reportedly lost their jobs. The changes came after protesters early this month demanded faster and more comprehensive reforms from the transitional government. Dr. Farah Ibrahim Al-Aga, chair of the Sudan Blue Nile Forum, says Sudanese are feeling the pinch from devaluation across the board.
The cabinet reshuffle, it happened according to the desire of the Sudanese people, who demonstrated in the 30th of June. Their aspiration was to change this Hamdok government for their bad performance within the time which they are running the country. Everything is devaluating. Food, petrol, medicine, social security, peace process, everything is devaluating. And people are suffering from the lack of the daily needs and also the very high prices, which is created a very expensive life for the people. And most of the Sudanese, as you know, they are poor. Because most of them are displaced, and most of them also, they are in the rural area, affected by war, affected by the social crisis, which is creating a lot of violations. This is why the people were demonstrating to change this government.
But Dr. Aga, why the finance minister? Because people thought that the finance minister was doing a very good job.
The finance minister, he was depending for his support. Unfortunately, he didn't succeed. Because the conference of the Sudanese Friends, which has been held in Berlin, the promise of this conference is not going to pay for them written now. According to the declaration of the European ambassador, this donation, the Sudanese cannot receive it before the coming year or more. This declaration shows the Sudanese people that the Europeans by now are not going to support the Ando government because they fail in the finance battle and also in political battle. And all these things based on the American punishment for putting the Sudan in the listing of terrorism. This is why it is not easy for the Europeans to help the Sudan to receive any support. And also the American laws that prevent those whom are on the terrorism list to find any support from the international financial organization. These are the complications that make all difference.
Prime Minister Hamdok earlier this week dismissed the police chief and his deputy. People might think that the Sudanese people are not giving the Prime Minister some time to bring about the reforms.
You know the complications in this government. This government is structured from different parties whom are carrying the different ideologies. The Communist Party and the leftists, they don't believe in the reform of the International Bank. And they say that all these policies of the International Bank will never support the country to push forward in making better life for the Sudanese. This is why the Minister of Finance says a lot of complications within the parties whom are refreshing what is called FFC. FFC, these are the alliances and groups of the parties whom is structuring the government. They are carrying different economical visions, politically and socially.
Dr. Farah Ibrahim Aga is chair of the Sudan Blue Nile Forum. He was speaking with us from the capital, Khartoum. The United Nations said this week that landmines planted by rebels in Libya have killed and wounded nearly 140 people in the south of the capital, Tripoli, over the past 2 months. Heather Murdoch reports.
In a video shared widely in early June, a man sits on the ground with blood on his face and one leg splayed lifeless to the side. "Where am I?" he asks in Libyan Arabic. The man holding the camera tells him he's on the airport road in Tripoli. His car hit an IED, improvised explosive device, and his companion was killed. On Sunday, another blast killed two humanitarian workers who were going house to house to remove explosive devices from civilian areas that not long ago were battle zones. This is 22-year-old Ahmed bin Mahmoud. His childhood friend, Tariq, was one of the victims. Witnesses told him Tariq and his colleagues were looking for bombs in the home of an elderly man. They found one and deactivated it. But another was hidden below, and two of the three men were killed when it exploded. 81 of the 138 victims were civilians, and many others were cleaning mines when they died. In February, the United Nations Mining Agency warned that Libya is awash with explosives, which pose a grave threat to civilians. This is Bob Seddon of the UN Mine Action Service in Libya.
Libya has the world's largest uncontrolled ammunition stockpile. It is estimated that there are between 150,000 and 200,000 tons of uncontrolled munitions across Libya.
The UN support mission in Libya says the bombs were planted by Libya's eastern forces, the Libyan National Army, which is loyal to strongman and de facto eastern leader Khalifa Haftar. Haftar's forces have been fighting those loyal to the Western government, the UN-recognized Government of National Accord, for more than a year since Haftar announced his intention to take Tripoli, the Western capital, by force. In early June, Haftar's forces withdrew from Tripoli, but both sides have since been supplied with massive amounts of weapons and air and ground support from other countries vying for power in Africa's most oil-rich country. Observers warn that while the fighting has been minimal recently, the stage is set for a protracted proxy war between powerful rivals like Turkey and Russia. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Egypt, where five-time CAF Champions League winner Zamalek of Egypt resumed their training on Thursday after 4 months of recess, during which time football activities were suspended in Egypt. French coach Patrice Carteron decided to divide the players into two groups to maintain social distancing between the players in accordance with the instructions of the Sports and Youth Ministry. Egypt had suspended sports activities since mid-March due to the coronavirus outbreak, but the government has decided to allow sports to resume starting on the 20th of June. Elsewhere in South Africa, that country's Premier Soccer League has reportedly proposed July 19th as the return date for competitive football in South Africa. However, the proposed July 19th date is subject to approval from both the South African Football Association and the country's government. Several Premier Soccer League teams returned to training ground late last week, while others only allow their players to train together this week. Defending Premier Soccer League champions Mamelodi Sundowns is one of such clubs. Head coach Pitso Masumane says it is good to be back, although things are a lot different.
We just met here. It's a bit strange. It's a strange feeling where we met. You know, when we meet, we always meet at a certain time and we are always together, you know, hugging each other, greeting each other, because it's 3 months we haven't seen each other. But the funny part of it is that how do we meet? We meet on the WhatsApp group, as the rules been put by the doctors, no hanging around, no loitering, you know. So yeah, it's a strange feeling, but it is the way the situation is. We have to respect COVID-19.
In Ghana, female football got a boost after the Ghana Football Association and the Youth Employment Authority under the Ghana's Ministry of Youth and Sports signed a deal for women's football that will see women's Premier League players paid monthly allowances for a period of 6 months. Under the initiative, as many as 480 female footballers in the Women's Premier League will receive a monthly allowance, plus 20 other people serving in the sector. The Ghana Football Association president, Kwart Okraku, revealed that a deal worth over $258,000 will go down as the most impactful initiatives women's football in Ghana has witnessed ever since its establishment.
This is a game changer. I'm saying this is a game changer, especially for football and especially for women football. We have 16 women Premier League clubs in Ghana who play for free.
And on to East Africa with. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend Show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Border Crossings. The Voice of America's Request Hour brings you an hour of great music and an escape from the news headlines, which aren't too good every single day. Tune in at 1500 Universal to Border Crossing. Make your requests by calling 202-619-2077, and we'll forget about all of our troubles and enjoy an hour of great music. Tune us in, Border Crossings, on the Voice of America.